Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Nate James is an English singer and songwriter. He released his debut soul album Set the Tone in 2005, which won him 2 MOBO nominations for Best Newcomer and Best R&B Artist. The album featured his revered first single Set the Tone, and he released this on his Fro Funk imprint via independent labels around the world and became one of the most successful independent soul recording artists globally. Nate has sold over 1 million albums, and he has had airplay hits in both Europe and Japan. Nate continues to release successful singles and albums the world over. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Nate James. Where do we find you in the world, and how are you doing?
Where do you find me right now? Is at home in Scotland. I am very well. I've had a really good day. Sun's been shining, sky's been blue. Got a lot of stuff done, prepping for this week to come to London and record more tracks for the album and do my lectures I have to teach and so on and so forth. So yeah, I'm good. I'm ready for a good week.
So you live in Scotland, but you commute.
I do.
How long is the journey?
Between 5 and 6 hours, depending on whether the trains are running correctly, which we kind of gauge like week to week what's going on. So
do you go up every single week?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's hectic. Don't you find it tiring?
I do, but my peace and my other half and my zen is back in Scotland, and I need that from London. Okay. So I spend 4 days a week there and 3 days a week here, and it's fine. I get 6 hours on the train to do my teachings. I'm writing my first book right now, so my lesson plans and all that gets done on the train, so I get the gift of time on the train. Okay. Which is fine by me.
What motivated you to write a book?
I was actually approached to write a book. I did my master's degree last year, and I wrote a thesis about representation and authenticity of queer and gay artists in the industry. I got a first in my thesis, and then I was at the Groucho Club in London, and I was chatting to a lady on the balcony, and she was like, so I'm actually a literary agent, and you fascinate me and what you've written about. I'd like you to make a book about it. Would you be interested? I'm like, yeah, let's do it. So it's actually really, really good for me as a gay man, obviously now out and proud. It's really good for sort of soul searching and kind of reliving my journey. And hopefully the book will be some kind of beacon for those people who are, you know, maybe a bit confused or a bit, you know, troubled in their lives and their sexuality and so on. So yeah, I kind of wrote the thesis and now I'm writing the book as like an extension of that. So I'm really excited. It's going to be a hell of a year, an album, a book and a documentary. So yeah.
Okay, so what is the book, an extension of your life? Is it sort of an autobiography?
Yeah, it's part autobiographical, and also it's kind of, you know, it's backed up with factual, you know, talking about the HIV stigma of the 80s and the artists that have come before me to enable me and the likes of Sam Smith and so on to kind of be their true self on stage and know how has that been possible now? Has it been a change in society? Has it been the way that the media has approached the idea or the people that are involved? So yeah, it's kind of discussing just the way of the world, but also adding a personal touch to it as well. So yeah, it's been really good.
And how far along are you with the book?
Halfway through the album, halfway through the book.
Okay, we'll get to the album just now. So I'm fascinated by this book. So when you started it, obviously a thesis is very different to a book. How many pages is a thesis, actually?
It was 12,000 words.
Okay, so in correlation to a book, obviously it's much smaller. So did you just approach it the same way you did the thesis, or was there a bit of hesitation or like, can I do this, inverted commas? Or you just, okay, I'm just going to get cracking.
I mean, having gone back to school at 43 years old to do a master's degree without an actual bachelor's degree, I was like, well, I've done that. So I feel like I can pretty much accomplish anything now. I mean, the book is going to be around 80,000 to 100,000 words. So more like a PhD, a doctorate. But yeah, it's kind of the thesis was obviously very academically written, and it was very factual and that kind of a basis. This is more like looking at each chapter I pen the thesis and then like putting my personal input into it to make it a bit more reader friendly, a bit more personable, and hopefully a bit more relatable to people. So yeah, it's been an interesting process.
What do you lecture? What do you teach?
I teach music business. I teach artist development. I teach ticketing and touring in the live industry. I teach history of pop, and I teach songwriting.
And how long have you been doing that?
I started straight off the back of my master's at LCCM in Southwark. I just taught two modules last year, and now I'm teaching five, and I'm head of three. So it's been what, 6 months?
Oh, wow. And
Yeah.
what was the motivation behind teaching and lecturing?
I actually went to the college to do a talk. My old manager is actually the principal of the college, and I did a like a TED talk with him, and we talked about how we kind of did our thing in the industry with being independent, owning my master's and so on back in the early 2000s. And he just called me in to have a chat with him on stage, and the head of programming for the college was there, and she was like, "I want you on my staff." And I was like, okay. She's like, "Don't worry about training." Like, basically, because obviously, lecturers that are actually trained as teachers are there to kind of teach the curriculum. Myself, I'm kind of more there to kind of back that up with the personal experience and the lived experience that the students don't necessarily get. So, and then off the back of that, it seems I did quite a good job. So they've just kind of gone on me this semester, but it's fine. I love it. I have a really good relationship with my students. They all seem to really enjoy the class. So they tell me. And I just go in there and just kind of tell them, what I've been through, what they can expect, and just try and, it's just guiding young minds. It's foundation students, degree students, and master students I teach. So yeah, it's been a very interesting journey. And I just love it. It's nice to have a routine again. Yeah, it seems like what I'm doing is doing some good, so I'm happy with that.
So was it a surprise when they approached you?
I mean, I guess something that I said on stage kind of struck a tone with Ipek, who's the head of programming. And yeah, I mean, a lot of the students I taught last semester are also in my modules for this year, so that was nice to have some friendly faces in the room. I was quite nervous when I first started, but my friend was like, "It's just another stage. It's just another performance. It's just another, there's no microphone in your hand. You're not, there's not thousands of people. It's another stage. So just treat it as that." And I was like, "Oh yeah." So I basically go to work and I get on stage in front of an audience of students, and I talk about myself and about the industry and all the changes that have happened in the past, well, 10, 20 years, and beyond. So it's been a really, really, really exciting, start to the year.
Okay, so now let's rewind. Let's dive into the music world. At what age, whether it was as a child or teenager, do you think or feel, cool, this is my path? How did that develop and evolve to where we are today?
So I used to sing all the time in my bedroom. It was one time I was singing a Boyz II Men song, and my mum, I opened the door to go get a glass of water, and my mum was on the stairs just crying, saying like, "Do you need to do something with this gift? Like, you sound so amazing." And it's the first time I kind of realized that singing, me singing, was would affect someone's emotion and their mood. And that's to this day kind of not why I do it. I'm not trying to make people cry, obviously, but it was just a nice touch that someone felt what I was singing about. So I was at school. I did all the sort of stage performances of like Fiddler on the Roof and Aladdin and Little Shop of Horrors, the usual, and Pharaoh and Joseph, Cake with Foundation, and a sheet tied around my head and all that sort of stuff. And then I was found. I was a model as a teenager, and I was found by a producer in London who got in touch with my agency out of the blue and just asked if there were any singers on the books. And my name was mentioned, and then I went down to London and sang for him. Next thing I knew, I was in a boy group. This was in like 97. And then we got a massive deal with Warner Brothers at the time. And we were on the label for probably 2 years, and then the label fell apart. The MD was sacked, the CEO was sacked, the usual, political switch around in a label. And then we were dropped, sadly, off the back of that. So I moved home. And I worked in a hotel for about 2 years and hated music and didn't want to be involved in the industry because I've been quite burnt. And then my manager, who I mentioned earlier, Anthony, drove up from London to come and see me. And he was like, "Look, I'm not trying to make you an artist, but I heard the songs you've written. I think you'd be a great songwriter. So how about we look at getting you a publishing deal?" And then I was signed to Universal as a writer, Universal Publishing. And then I was writing songs for Blue for Craig David, for Lamar, for people that were kind of around at the time. And then I realized I didn't really want to give these people my songs because they were my stories, they were my adventures and my journeys. And I was like, you know what? I've got enough money in the bank. I could actually just record an album. So that's what we did. Had major label deals on the table from all the labels at the time. This was around about 2000, 2002. And I just said no. And I was like, I want to do this myself. And Anthony was like, okay, let's do it. You know, and he guided me into copyright and intellectual property and owning my own masters and how to assign that and so on. And I think I was one of the first artists in the UK to actually release my own music and own my own masters. And then let's see, that was 2005 was the first album, 2009 was the second album. Did The Voice UK in 2013, The Voice of Holland 2018. And probably around 2015, I was still writing songs ferociously in the studio. And then I released a song called In My Skin, which is my coming out story, I guess, in music and to the industry and to the public that didn't know already. And I just thought, you know what, In My Skin is a really cool title for an album because it's just kind of like, this is what it is like to be me. This is what I've been through. This is what I've, you know, had to deal with personally, internally, externally, all those things. And so I released that song and then I went back in the studio. When was it? I started recording the new album in January. So very fresh. And I sat in the studio in Cornwall with Mark Hill, who's obviously behind Art of Dodger and Craig David. And we sat in the room and he was playing, you know, the demos I recorded with him the end of last year. And I was like, can I do this again? Like, have I got that in me again at 44 to do this again? And I just started singing the first song and I was like, oh yeah. I'm back. Like this is where I'm meant to be, in the studio making the magic, with Mark, who I've loved as one of my favorite all time producers. And so yeah, we're halfway through it, and that's here we are now with you on camera.
Okay, so many things I have to ask. Let's
Okay.
first question. So you said you did the first song, the In Your Skin, in 2015. Am I correct? Did I get that correct here?
No, so I was writing songs from 2015 for this
Oh,
album.
okay.
2000 In My Skin, I think we released it maybe 2018,
Okay.
29. I think it's 7 years old. So yeah, 2017. So I went to Nashville on a writing trip for a few months and I met a producer over there and we started writing and he was like, what do you want to write about? I was like, I want to write about me coming out, but I don't want to be like it'd be like I'm gay, here I am, all that stuff. I want to write something about embracing who you are.
Yeah.
And being truthful to yourself, being honest with yourself, and just stating the fact that you're comfortable in your skin, and that's okay. And so I wrote it in such a way that I knew it was about for me, but obviously anyone else listening to it can interpret it as they see fit and apply it to their own life story.
You mentioned that when you got into the studio, you were like, you're 44, can you do this again? So was that maybe what was holding you back from getting into the studio, just some resistance, or was it just that you were busy with other things?
I didn't really have any desire to necessarily make another album. It wasn't like a label breathing down my neck or a manager or anything breathing. I was living life. I got engaged. I moved to Scotland. Obviously, the pandemic happened. There were so many other things that were going on. So making an album wasn't the top priority for me. I think having written my thesis last year, and the research I was doing for a year before that about, you know, being a gay artist and what that has involved over the years and what people have had to endure over the years. I think I was like, you know what? I need to actually do more about this and not be a beacon, but maybe just kind of be a bit of a louder voice than I have been about myself, but also about the fact that we are who we are and that shouldn't be, you know, and there shouldn't be any negative comeback from that at all. And I think then doing the masters and kind of learning more about the industry at Westminster, than I already knew. And then obviously choosing this as my focal point for my thesis, it really kind of fine-tuned my mindset to be like, there's been a lot of bad stuff that's gone down over the years, and it still goes on now, you know, as far as the LGBTQIA community is concerned, and artists within that. I mean, my apprehension of can I do this again was like, can I make another album and it be, you know, the best work I've done. And it's a very honest album. There's some real kind of home truths being told in this record about myself and about the world around me. Is it too controversial? Is it too political? Is it too this? You know, all the kind of questions that artists ask themselves when they're creating something new. You don't want to offend anyone, I like to say I'm trying to inform people, of my journey and also about things they may not know about that have gone on with me and, like I say, and around me as well. So it was a real soul. It's been a real soul searching project. And there's some songs there about my partner now and love lost before. And yeah, I mean, you'll hear. It's coming. And I'm just really enjoying the process of doing it again at my own pace, with an amazing producer and collaborator, some amazing writers I've waited for years to work with. So yeah, it's going to be pretty special when it comes out.
I can see by the look on your face as you're speaking about it. So for the listeners, he's got this glowing smile. His whole face is glowing. So I can just feel it. I'm looking forward to that. Okay. So has things improved for the LGBT community in the music entertainment world, or are we still a couple of steps forward, a couple of steps back? Because obviously we see a lot of these I'm also part of the LGBT community, but we see a lot of these like Sam Smith and Troye Sivan and a lot of Kim Petras and a whole lot of different artists that are being authentic. But it's taken a long journey for them to get there. A lot of people on the outside are thinking, oh, cool, it's okay. And it's okay for them to do that. But from being in the industry yourself, is there still backlash and people saying to them, no, you can't be who you are?
I mean, we haven't got forever, and we could talk about this forever, believe me, with what I've learned over the past year. I think that visibility is greater. That's number one. Okay. So artists are not necessarily, well, I mean, some of them still are, but they're not necessarily hiding themselves anymore. They exist in a world, in an industry where it's gone from if you're gay, you hide it, to if you're gay, labels want to sign you because you're a novelty and that's what's in right now. So the industry itself has switched in their opinion of artists from the LGBTQIA community, in the sense that, like I say, if you're in a boy band back in the day, in the 90s or 2000s, Stephen Gately was petrified of coming out. Duncan James was petrified of coming out. I was petrified of coming out. It wasn't a cool thing. It wasn't the in thing. It would more have a negative effect on your sales and on your fan base if you had a gay member. Now, I mean, if you don't have a gay member, what's wrong with you? It's kind of the thing. Like, where's the queer one? Where's the, you know what I mean? Like, it's that novelty. The visibility side of things has kind of backlashed, I think, a lot on the trans community, because the trans community have been struggling themselves for a long time. And as visibility has grown for the community as a whole, I feel like a lot of light's been shone on them that they don't necessarily want or they didn't want. And I think that because, again, society likes to put people into a box. To understand something, you want to categorize it. You have to put it in a box alongside other things, so you're familiar. And no one deserves to be put in a box, no matter, what your gender or non-binary, your whatever you are or whoever you are, you don't need to be put in a box. You are you, and that should be a fundamental across the board fact. As far as acceptance is concerned and understanding, I mean, Sam Smith, when he first came out as an artist, was very sort of Michael Bublé, very groomed, very slim, very suited and booted. And obviously, I mean, they've sold a lot of records and they've earned their stars to allow themselves to be who they want to be without any backlash from anyone. Now, the thing is with Sam, especially, which makes me really sad for them, is that, people have said, yeah, spread your wings and be as queer as you want to be. And now they're trying to clip it. They're trying to clip the wings. That's too queer. That's too much. The Grammys and so on, the performances where Sam has exercised his right to be this fabulous character. Even the LGBTQIA community has kicked back saying, oh, Sam's gone too far. How define too far? You've been crying out for years to have someone who is a beacon, who stands for who you are, and there is someone out there standing for who you are, and you're shooting them down. And that really pisses me off, because it's not fair. You can't say go fly and, like I say, clip someone's wings. So one step forward, two steps back. There's been a lot of one steps forwards, but there's been plentiful steps back. The LGBTQIA plus bubble, or the umbrella I call it, there's a lot of infighting within our community that does not need to exist. Everyone's been fighting for so long to be heard outside of our umbrella, outside of our bubble. And now we're being heard. The cracks are starting to show within the community. And that is something that concerns me, because I'm like, we should be united and unified
Yes.
and have a singular voice saying, I mean, not we're here, we're queer, but you know what I mean? Like, that's too cliche, but literally that. And it's not happening. And I feel like there needs to be a lot more unity with amongst the community, because that will make it a stronger, will be a stronger body of people
Exactly.
to combat all the other shit that's thrown our way on a weekly or monthly or yearly basis, or daily for that matter. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I've said for the longest time, and excuse me, listeners, if I offend anyone, I think humans are the stupidest people or the stupidest race in the world because they're still killing each other over differences for thousands of years because one person does this that's not in their, path or reads this book or looks like that or is this whatever. And it's like they're still doing it. You would have thought after all these thousands of years, they would have woken up. And it makes me angry. They're still doing
Same.
that
I was like, well, you heard
nonsense.
my answer to that question. Well, I was being as polite as I could be, but
Yeah.
no, there's a lot of work to be done. And it is, I mean, I'm the son of a black man and a white woman, and I'm gay. Like, people have said to me, like, why are you making your life hard for yourself? And I'm like, what?
Like, how
What?
exactly?
What does that mean? Like,
Exactly.
well, you're mixed race and you're gay. I'm like, yeah.
Yes.
What's the point? It's like, it's almost like, oh, you've got enough troubles on your plate as it is without saying now you're gay. I'm like, I need to just walk away from this situation because I'm about to wallop someone, So yeah, I get what you mean. Like, totally. Humans can be a bit slow on the uptake. Let's put it that way. We'll put
That's
it
only
that way. Not
nice.
stupid. Slow on the uptake.
What was your motivation behind entering the Voice UK and The Voice? Was it you said Holland? So what was the motivation around that, and what was your experience of each?
Well, I was scouted for both. So, they have
Oh.
scouts that go out and they ask certain people who they think may bring a certain level of a certain kudos to the show. So I was scouted for both
Oh,
shows.
really? I never knew they scouted for. I thought people just
God, yeah,
entered.
all the shows do.
Oh.
BGT, American Idol, they scout. Oh yeah, there's open auditions as well, but they do have a pool of people that they will reach out to entice
Oh,
them into the
okay.
show. My experience on The Voice UK, albeit that it was on BBC at the time, was not that great. The best thing I got out of the show was the friends I made. Jesse, Jay, and I have known each other for a long time, and the media were like, "Oh, it's a fix. Jesse knew it was Nate. How does she know it's me? Her back's turned." That's such a retarded thing to say. So anyway, so we didn't have a great time on the UK one. My manager at the time actually released the greatest hits, or like a best of album, digitally, the week before my show. And the lawyers of The Voice called me and said that I had to take they had he had to take it down. And I was like, I can't force someone who co-owns my rights to take anything down. He's at liberty to do that. And they were like, take it down or we'll cut you from the show. So there was quite a bit of bullying going on from The Voice UK, which I didn't take to very well. Probably why I didn't go very far in the competition. And then The Voice of Holland, again, I used to DJ in the W Hotel in Amsterdam once a month. I go over there and do an event, which is great fun. My brother lives over there with his family, so I would go to Amsterdam every month. And one night I was there, and a friend of mine was the stylist on The Voice, and he was with one of the producers, and I told her all about me, and she's like, you need to come on our show. And I was like, really? But the thing is, the Dutch version is actually the original version. Talpa is the company that actually developed the concept for The Voice, and the
Oh,
whole
okay.
platform was developed in Holland. So for me, I was quite honored that the mothership was like basically calling me home to go and do it there. So that was cool. I mean, again, I got to the battles. I didn't do them to win. I did them to kind of boost my profile a bit, get some more streams up, get the profile up, and just kind of reintroduce myself, but also introduce myself to a different market. I wasn't really in the commercial market at the time, and it was really interesting because on my socials, all these people were like, "Oh my God, this new artist, Nate James!" And all my fans who've been knowing me for like the longest time are like, "Nate's been around for ages. Nate's a boss. Like, here, check out this track. Check out this track." So
Yeah.
it was quite cool that I didn't actually say anything myself. It was like the super fans and the people that supported me from day
Yeah.
dot were like, "Educate yourself on this guy." So that was kind of cool. It was a moment. It was 5 years apart. I got out of it what I wanted to, and I've been asked again since, and obviously point blank said no. I'm like, I'm not doing that shit again. But it was good.
So from 0 to 3 to 4 minutes of creating a song, you've mentioned it's about your journey, your voice. Is it easy every time? You've already touched on what motivates it, what inspires it. Let's unpack a little further, your creative brain.
I mean, 9 times out of 10, I'll go into a studio. My phone is just full of vocal and lyrical doodles, I call them. I could wake up at 3 in the morning and have an idea for a chorus. I can be on the tube to work or on the train down to London and be like, oh, that's a really good lyric, and type it in my phone. When I go into a studio, especially with Mark, who's obviously, I mean, Christ, he's won so many awards and sold millions around the world in various forms. I go in and I go, right, I've got an idea for this, and I'll start singing it. He'll start playing, and before we know it, we've got a whole song done. It's a very easy process. Sometimes you get writer's block, and you sort of sat there like, oh, God, what the hell should I say next? What's the word? And also, like, I'm a big advocate. Like, if you want to say "I love you" in a song, just say it. Don't go in on a rhyme zone and try and find 100 other ways of saying "I love you." If it works, it works.
Yes.
If it's the word that I don't overthink songs. There's certain songs on the album that are a little bit deeper than just writing a pop song. I'm also very aware, not that it affects my writing, but Spotify and so on these days, anything less than 30 seconds doesn't count as a stream. So you're gonna almost kind of have to, shoot your whole load, sorry for the pun, in the first 30 seconds for someone to then listen to the rest of the song, which is really
Yes.
unfair. That's a bit shit. I've written songs the way I always do. Sometimes I'll go into the room and have not a clue of what I'm going to write about, and again, someone will start plucking a guitar or playing the keys, and I'm like, that's beautiful, play that again, keep that on loop. And then again, before we know it, the song's written. I've been working with Michelle Escoffrey as well, who's one of my favorite writers of all time. She worked with me when I was in the boy group I was in. She's written for Tina Turner, Liberty X, a lot of big artists over the years as well. So she and I have been big sister and little brother for a long time. So having me, Michelle, and Mark in the studio at the same time was just a blessing. And my A-team, dream team, whatever you want to call it, I've been waiting for a long time. So I kind of like, as much as this album is my baby, and I've very much been like, this is the vision I want for this record, this is the sound I want, I'm co-producing as well, just kind of very immersed in the whole process. I had a great team of people around me that were helping me bring that to life.
So you referenced Spotify. Okay, so we're going there. I love me a CD. I still buy my CDs every month. For me, it's an energy exchange to you guys for saying thank you for all the hard work. I love the booklets, the images, the thank yous, all those type of things. I'm sure you are aware that
The
CDs,
same.
even cassettes and vinyls, are making a massive comeback.
They are.
And then we've got these digital platforms, as you referenced. What are your perceptions and observations of where the industry is at the moment?
I think that the industry has been a streamer's or a skipper's paradise for a long time. We've all been guilty of skipping past the track. For me, as I said to my students all the time, like me, if there's an artist or an album that I love, I will buy the CD, I will open the booklet, I will read every lyric, who wrote it, who A&R'd it, who played trumpet, who played keys, who played every single aspect of that album. I want to know, because normally I'm like, right, let's get them on, let's get them playing bass. You know what I mean? Like, I do my research through reading the booklets in a massive way. I always have done. I'll go to record exchange stores and Rough Trade and so on to buy the vinyl. I think the interesting thing that's happened in the past year or so, or maybe even the past 6 months, there was an interview with Lucian Grainge, who's CEO of Universal. And, a lot of people don't think a lot of him. I think he's a great guy. I've met him a few times. He has done wonders to keep Universal at the level it's at now. As to whether it's an artist-friendly label or not, we don't need to talk about that. That's another time. But he said that the interesting thing is that Universal are going to be targeting super fans, because as far as revenue goes, streaming is not really bringing in a lot of money. We don't know what the deals are that have been done between the labels and digital platforms, because they're sealed. We'll never know unless there's a legal case to open them. But the way that he said that, it made me think. And basically, if you've got a super fan who is going to spend £100 on the t-shirt, the vinyl, the book, the booklet, the CD, the whatever, the deluxe package, if you've got 1,000 super fans, that's £100,000. Like that.
Yes.
So I think the Universal are kind of consciously going to be targeting, well, the labels in general, because obviously they follow each other like sheep, let's be honest. But you know, when one's got one superstar female or trans artist, the next label's trying to sign the same thing to make
Yeah,
it
yeah,
the
yeah.
same but different, right? So I think that there's going to be a noticeable shift. I mean, my new album is going to be available on all formats, as in like I want to do a vinyl, a cassette, maybe like a yeah. I want it to be a real collector's project because I've waited 14 years to make this record, so I want everyone to enjoy it in whichever way they see fit as much as they can, you know. So all these people who have bought those, you know, the new vinyl players or a CD player for the first time, whatever, like I will be catering to all of you. You heard it here. But you know, I think that there's you just said, you know, it's the energy exchange. I love that. That's a really nice phrase you said. It's giving the energy and feeding the energy back into the artist and the money as well. You know, we're independent here. We're trying to make a buck. And albums are not cheap. Artwork is not cheap. The creative process is not cheap. You know what I mean? There's so many factors that go into an album, so much money is spent on them. It's just nice to hear someone like yourself who's like, you know, I want to invest in the artist, and it's a really special thing. So I think that it's only right to give those super fans and those people who are dedicated to collectibles and music in that way something special to have.
Love that. Perfect. And I'm definitely going to add your CD to my list. So,
Yay.
yay. So I love this game. I know if I had to ask this question in 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 50 years, I know your answer will be different every time because there are millions of them. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind. If you had to push play to five songs by other artists once we finish this conversation, what would those songs be and by whom?
Ooh, that's a great question. Stevie Wonder, Overjoyed. Michael Jackson, Remember the Time. Whitney Houston, I'm Your Baby Tonight. Luther Vandross, So Amazing. And Little Red Corvette, Prince.
Ah, I like that. Most of them are on my list, so a couple of knots, so I'll
Yeah.
just add them.
They're all, you know what? I love the new artists. You know, I love Adele. I mean, you know, I love a lot of new music, but if they're the last five songs I heard, you know, the day I died, they're probably those five, 100%.
Okay, cool. So, Nate, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
I would like to say this has been a delight. Thank you so much for having me. The album In My Skin will be out in August of this year. Please go buy it. Come see me on tour. Enjoy it. And anyone out there who's struggling with themselves in any way, Instagram direct message works. Give me a shout.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.